Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe. My guest today is Mary Kay Lombino, Curator of Collections at the Francis Lehman Loeb Art Center here at Vassar College. Mary Kay is back with us to talk about the photography exhibition currently on view at the center through December 13th. That exhibition is entitled Gordon Parks, The Making of an Argument. Welcome back, Mary Kay.
Thanks, Tom. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, it's nice to have you back. Gordon Parks, it's a name I think anyone interested in photography or the history of photography would know, and anyone interested in American culture, I think, should know. There's a compendiousness about his talent that, personally, I find just astonishing. He seemed to be adept at almost every medium one can name, besides being one of the great photographers of the second half of the 20th century. He was a filmmaker, a director, a novelist, a poet, an oil painter, and a composer. And he just seemed to be able to excel in everything he put his hand to right from the get-go. This exhibition focuses on just one series of photographs done for a photojournalism piece that he did for Life magazine on New York City gangs in 1948. But before we talk about the exhibition, I wonder if you can just talk a bit about Mr. Parks for people who might not be familiar with his work or his name.
Yeah, I'd be happy to, because I think it's such an amazing success story. His story, being born into poverty in Fort Scott, Kansas in 1912. His father was a farmer, and he went to a segregated elementary school. But by the time he got to high school, it was too small of a community to segregate. So they put all the kids together. But the black kids were really discriminated against. They weren't allowed to play sports or attend social activities. And they were really discouraged from going to college. And in one of his many memoirs, Park says that he was told that college for him would be a total waste of time and money. And so instead, he got out of school and he started working as an itinerant laborer, finding odd jobs. He was everything from a rail car porter to a brothel pianist, began his musical career that way, and among many other jobs, until he finally bought a camera at a pawn shop and taught himself to take pictures. So this idea of him kind of roaming from job to job possibly prepared him to become this Renaissance man that he became later in life, because, as you said, he was an author. He wrote many memoirs. A Hungry Heart is one of the more famous ones. The Learning Tree, Voices in the Mirror. His novels, such as Shannon, were read by many people. And, of course, his filmmaking and photography.
It's interesting. He's able to, work across all these media. But within a given medium, like photography, he seems to be able to do everything. I mean, he tries everything, and he's usually quite successful at what he does. As a filmmaker, for instance, he ranged from doing traditional feature films to independent films to documentaries to inventing, actually, a genre of commercial film, the so-called blaxploitation film with Shaft.
Yeah.
And same with music. He composed classical pieces as well as jazz. He was a musician as well as a composer. And then, of course, he has a range as a photographer, doesn't he?
Absolutely. And his range is stylistically very noticeable. If you see some of his very early pictures, he had done some fashion photography for Vogue, and he had worked for Ebony prior to 1948, when the work in this exhibition is all made. And that range is shown especially after he starts working for Life magazine, because their style is one that emphasizes very close cropping. But one thing that he just kept getting better and better at was portraiture and pictures of people, mostly because he had this amazing way of getting people to trust him. He was really known for that. But I think he also just wasn't afraid to try different things and wasn't nervous that he wasn't going to be able to do things. As a self-taught artist, he was kind of teaching himself on the job all the time.
Yeah, that's another thing. All these media he works in, he teaches himself everything. I mean, he didn't go off and get an MFA in photography or creative writing or whatever.
No, absolutely not. And in his autobiography, he talks a little bit about how he had to strike a balance between having a style, being an artist, expressing himself artistically, and also really bringing forward a lot of his social agenda. Mm-hmm. So he wanted to make a difference in people's lives, and he decided he could do that through art. But in order to do it through art, you have to make powerful art. Yeah. And I think he knew that very early on, instinctively, that if he could make his work beautiful or poetic in some way, that he could reach more people.
I wonder if this has anything to do with the fact that he starts out working with the Farm Security Administration.
Oh, yes. Very early on, he was with the Farm Security Administration, the FSA, and that brought him into contact with many different artists. Yeah. And it probably taught him a lot very early on in his career.
Yeah, and the really prominent artists are people like Walker Evans.
That's right. So we know that he had exposure to some of the best artists in the world, and that he would most likely be aware of most of the FSA artists who were well known.
Yeah. And he writes in his autobiography that, even when he was a Pullman porter, when he was in Chicago, say, he would spend his spare time in the Museum of Fine Arts. I mean, he was someone who liked to absorb culture.
Yeah. For someone who didn't grow up with any culture in his life, he went out and sought it and found it, and he learned a lot from it.
So can you talk about the show here generally? It's a traveling show, right?
Yes, that's right. So it was organized by Russell Lord. He is the curator of photography at the New Orleans Museum of Art. And he co-organized this, where he did so in collaboration with Peter Kuhnhart, who's the executive director of the Gordon Parks Foundation. And it's a wonderful thing that the foundation exists, and that it's such a huge archive of Gordon Parks' work. Mm-hmm. So just to give you a little background, they're based in Westchester County, mm-hmm. and they allow curators, or really anyone, to come in and use the archive however they wish. And so Russell Lord went there, found this particular body of work, which really spoke to him, because Russell's focus is really to look at photography through the lens of other media, and this really does that because it's through the lens of Life magazine. Mm. And the archive has so much material because Time Life Inc. decided at a certain point that they had too much material. Mm-hmm. And they offered back negatives and prints and all kinds of archival material to any living artists who were alive at that time. And Gordon Parks was, and he, of course, decided he wanted to take all of his materials back. And before he died, he started that foundation because, again, he was thinking about how to make a difference even after his death. And the Parks Foundation, by allowing many people to use this, has really promoted his career well beyond his death. And there are many exhibitions on Gordon Parks that are traveling around right now. And that's credit to the Gordon Parks Foundation.
To me as a librarian, the exhibition has a special appeal because it's the product of an archive. You can see it has a documentary flavor. There are, for instance, contact prints.
Yes. So that speaks to the content of the exhibition, which I can describe. It's an exhibition that focuses on one photo essay done in 1948 called Harlem Gang Leader. And that was Gordon Parks' first Life magazine essay. And prior to that, he didn't work for Life. No black artist had ever worked for Life, no photographer. And he went into the editor's office and showed them a portfolio of his. And he pitched this idea that he wanted to go into a gang-ridden neighborhood and work with gang members to get real live photographs of their activity and then create an article, a photo spread that would really bring awareness to the issues in that area and hopefully make a positive change. And the Life magazine editors loved the idea, and they allowed him to go out there and take the pictures. And he submitted those in negative form, submitted all those to Life magazine. And the exhibition shows the ways in which the Life magazine editors took that material and told a particular story. And their headline for the article was Harlem Gang Leader, Fear, Frustration, and Violence. And they wanted to tell that story. Mm-hmm. Very different from the story that Gordon Parks wanted to tell, which was one that he hoped would help the plight of the young black male. And instead, it portrayed this neighborhood as something that was a scary place to go. And it was almost like a warning to their middle-class white readership. And it sort of backfired. But the good news is that it allowed Gordon Parks to become a staff photographer mm-hmm. for Life magazine. Yeah. And he worked for more than 20 years mm-hmm. doing photo essays for Life magazine. And over those years, he really began to understand how he could gain more agency and really have his social message be presented through that magazine. And later on, you'll see some of the photo essays that he did, and it would say Photos and Text by Gordon Parks, because he was able to take charge of the message that was being produced.
Can you talk about Life magazine in general? I mean, how does Life magazine fit into the history of photography this time?
So by the late 1940s, Life magazine was at the height of its influence, and it had a subscriber list of 5 million people, but many, many more readers. One in five Americans, adult Americans, were reading it. And it was mostly this white middle-class readership, people who had power and influence. And Parks really knew that and wanted to reach those people. And during the 1930s, their record for representing African Americans was abysmal. Yeah. In one of the headlines, they used the N-word, and it was in quotes, but there it was in black and white. And there were many things that today we would consider to be just horribly racist. But one thing that did feel right to Gordon Parks was that Life magazine believed in the power of the photograph and the power of the photo essay, which is basically a story in pictures with some captions and with a brief written section. And often those sections would be written by a writer who would go out with the photographer and get to know the people that were being photographed and see what stories were being captured. But because this was a very special relationship between Gordon Parks and a young gang member named Red Jackson, there wasn't any room for a writer to be along with them. So the Life magazine editors had to take Parks's story as the truth. Yeah. And then they wrote their own story based on those pictures. But maybe some of the truth gets lost in that process.
Is that because of the force of the narrative, that you have to have a storyline and, you know, the editors feel they have to stick to it, and certainly there's going to be some kind of a sensational aspect to it, or at least something to hold people's attention?
That's right, and to get people's attention, too.
Yes, yes.
This was a magazine that was well-versed in photojournalistic ideas and how to get a message out, and they were good at what they did. So they weren't going to tell a little bit of this story and a little bit of that, and maybe even some of the nuance gets lost when you're focusing on one story: fear, frustration, and violence in Harlem. And that's the message that they wanted to present.
And then there are competing priorities also, in that the magazine, it's full of advertisements which do actually affect the narrative sometimes.
Absolutely.
What you can say.
It becomes this kind of visual noise along the margins of the story, and even butted right up against some of Gordon Parks's pictures are these flamboyant ads that really do distract you and take your attention away. And the exhibition really shows that, because what the exhibition does is it breaks it up into three different rooms, three sections. Mm-hmm. And the first room really just shows the pictures themselves. They're all the pictures that were chosen for the magazine, but they have no captions and no labels, because we decided that it would be best for the pictures just to be looked at and understood on a visual level without any sort of influence of words. And it's unconventional for us to have anything on the walls without a label next to it.
Yeah.
But it does allow you to just simply look. And then in the second gallery, you see the spreads of every different page of the magazine that this photo essay appeared in, along with the ads, all of these captions, big splashy headlines, things that are compelling to their readers. And then in the last room, there are many photographs that were not chosen by Life magazine that paint a slightly different picture, and in some cases a very different picture, of Red Jackson's life and how a gang member has to struggle with some of the difficulties of violence and also choice and being a leader in your neighborhood and things like that.
So in the show itself, the show has a narrative then also, and is there a critique here, in a sense, of Life magazine or of this kind of medium, or at least an exploration of the kind of tension that comes up when you have someone trying to put a social message out in a medium that's basically designed to sell products and sell itself?
Yeah, for sure. There's a message there in the exhibition that shines a light on the editing process. The section with the magazine itself is called Making. And so you then, as a viewer, you're able to see that that photo essay was made, not necessarily by Parks himself, but by the magazine editors. And then the last section is called Selecting. And it shows that there was a lot of editing done because certain things didn't get selected. And so this idea of unpacking something that we already know exists, especially today. People who use Instagram and Facebook and other social media know that there's an editing process that happens with everything.
Yes, everything is curation now for people.
Yes, so every picture we take, we kind of fix it to make it look better, make us look like better photographers, you know, make our lives look better. And so we understand the editing process in the 21st century, but to shine a light on how this happened even as early as 1948 for a magazine, it's nothing we don't know, but it's really interesting to see that process.
Yeah. Does Parks, in his contribution to the essay itself through his photography, is there an implied critique there as well of the medium or the constraints that are put on him, do you think?
There are, because this is a little bit complicated, because there's two layers to the idea of Red Jackson, this 17-year-old gang member, gang leader, and how he becomes used. Mm-hmm. When Gordon Parks first asked him if he would be the subject of this major photo essay for Life magazine, Red Jackson said, "No, why would I do that? Allow all these white people to read about my life and to see me doing violent things that I sometimes do in my life as a gang member. That seems crazy." But it turns out he was able to convince him because he had this way with getting people to trust him. And because he had a cool car, mm-hmm. Red Jackson wanted to ride in his Buick. And
Buick Roadmaster.
That's right. Yeah. So a few things convinced him to do it. But Parks was really walking this line of whether or not he was collaborating with this young boy or if there was some sense of exploitation happening because he's using his image to get his message out. And there's inside the whole story, there's a sort of sub-story of a day when Red Jackson was elected to be boy mayor of Harlem.
An extremely interesting part of the exhibition.
I think so, for many reasons. One reason is because Gordon Parks felt it was so important. He took hundreds of pictures of the boy mayor episode. And this was a day where Red was brought into the mayor's office and met all of these officials. And he was given, for instance, a YMCA card. And he's very excited about getting that card. And he's given a ride in a very fancy Buick convertible. And he wears a suit and he looks official. He gets his picture taken for the newspaper a lot. And then at the end of the day, it turns out his YMCA card is a fake. He can't even use it. And once the newspaper guys leave, Red Jackson's kind of left on his own. He has to walk these 20 blocks home by himself.
It's a wonderful photograph of that.
Yes, and it's the last photograph of the photo essay in Life magazine. And he has to, like, you know, buy himself a hot dog on the way home. Yeah. They didn't even buy him lunch on this big day where he was supposed to be honored.
Yes.
So there's an element in which Red Jackson's getting manipulated or exploited there. And then maybe again when he poses for the pictures that Parks takes.
How was the story received? I mean, I know it made a splash.
Yes. You have to imagine that for the readership of Life magazine, there were very few options for understanding the life of a black family or a black gang member. So this was really something a lot of people sought out and really wanted to read about. Also, the Life magazine editors obviously really liked it because it wasn't until after that that they offered him a full-time job and he began a career as the first black photographer, but also the only black photographer for Life magazine for over 20 years after that.
We're so saturated with images now, but at the time there was mass media, and of course the newspapers had newspaper photography, but there wasn't as much access to images in the world as we have now. And I'm thinking one of the things that made Life what it was their coverage of Second World War, and it brought home, you know, what the war actually looked like to people in a way that they couldn't see. You know, they didn't have television at the time. They just had to imagine before that. So.
And Life magazine was known for that, and they prided themselves on that, and this idea of the power of the photograph was important. And being able to strike the balance of being news but also entertainment, that was a big part of what Life magazine was. So people wanted to get their news there, but they didn't want to get it from something as dry as a newspaper. something like a magazine was much more exciting.
Yeah. Does the exhibition, do you think, have anything to tell us, or is it made especially relevant, do you think, by Ferguson and Trayvon Martin? And it seems like every day you read about young black men being shot down by police, where the police don't seem to be defending themselves.
Yes. If you do go back a couple of years and you see stories like Trayvon Martin, where this young black kid was seen as a criminal, even though he was not, and he died for that at the hands of a white man. We have to wonder, we feel like we've come so far since 1948, but if you look at these current events in our lives, we realize that we still have so far to come in terms of race relations in the U.S., which is part of why I wanted to bring this exhibition to Vassar. I think it should resonate with an audience of today, because we are still struggling with these issues of race relations. And it's important to show that someone like Gordon Parks can bring that message home, regardless of his audience, and show that there's more than one side to a lot of these arguments. And I think there's also a question of whether or not we are looking at self-defense. Is this kid, Red Jackson, just defending himself when he engages in gang activity?
Yeah, it seems to be the motive for him joining the gang to begin with.
That's right. He needs to protect not only himself, but his family. He's got younger brothers and sisters. He says that his gang, the Midtowners, he made their street that they walk on up at 119th Street because on 99th Street, he wanted his mom to have a safe place to walk her dog. Mm-hmm. So there is a certain aspect of, is it violence for violence's sake, or are these kids really forced into these situations because they need to protect themselves and their families? And that's a hard line to walk for a 17-year-old kid, and one who's actually seen as somewhat of a leader, at least in his neighborhood. He helps younger kids, and he's understood as somebody who can really help decrease the amount of violence, but at the same time, he has to engage in it himself.
And Gordon Parks, that's part of what he's obviously trying to show here, that this young man is actually a community leader of a kind.
Yes, and that's why the Boy Mayor episode was so important to Parks. And those hundreds of pictures that he took of that episode, only two of them ended up in the magazine. Yeah. So it was really de-emphasized by Life magazine.
And one thing about the Trevor Martin and Ferguson news is that photography is very prominent here also. Video, cell phone videos, and it seems to be, generally speaking, a force for good, for shining a light on what is happening still on this day to especially young black men and social problems that need to be addressed.
And actually, it's much more prominent now because, of course, there are cameras everywhere.
Yes.
Everyone has a camera in their pocket. Yeah. Basically, people are very used to being photographed and videotaped constantly. And in fact, you know, a lot of cops actually have to have a video camera on them now when they're making an arrest or even pulling somebody over. But back then, seeing a guy walk the streets of Harlem with a camera was completely new. And so it was probably a big risk that Red was taking to allow this older man with a trench coat and a big camera walk around with him, because it was very noticeable.
So the exhibition is very timely in teaching us that it's good to be aware and understand the way images can be manipulated, but also about the power, the social power of photography. And in a way, we all have the option to be something like Gordon Parks in the world around us, that we can bring attention to things.
I hope so. And actually, I think younger people are even more aware of this, the rising generations. I just heard about an incident on a grammar school bus where a third grader videotaped his bus driver texting while driving, and the guy got fired. So you're never not on camera these days.
Never not on camera, no. So, as someone who's made a study of photography as an art form, is there anything about Parks that, you personally find inspiring, or anything that you would hope a young person aspiring to be a photographer might take away from it?
The photographs themselves are amazing photographs. If you step back a little bit from the subject matter of the show, which is very focused on this editing process for the magazine, you see these amazing portraits, often of this young guy, Red Jackson. In the first room, there's three of him, just little square pictures, maybe 10 by 10 inches, but they focus very closely on his face, and he's very animatedly telling a story about one time when his gang got jumped by another gang. Mm. And the pictures, you almost feel like you're right there. And then in the third gallery, there's many pictures of him sitting at home with his family.
Yes.
There's a poignant portrait, I think, of him sitting with his mom. He's holding her little ball of yarn while she does some knitting, and his older brother is sitting right at the floor in very close quarters, sketching in his sketchbook. And then a few really gorgeous pictures of the neighborhood of Harlem. And these are taken either right down on the street where you can see the kids close up, or at one point Parks goes up to one of the upper floors of the tenement buildings and looks down and gets this completely other perspective of the whole neighborhood of Harlem. And it's beautiful. And those actually show, these are some of the pieces that were not included
in the magazine.
But they really show how there was something very wholesome about that neighborhood. It was very family oriented, and kids would play in the street in a very sort of old-timey, wholesome way. And one wonderful picture that I love that's actually on the invitation for the show shows Red Jackson. He's shirtless and he's just got these buff arms and chest, and he's the guy with the wrench who's opening up the fire hydrant. And the fire hydrant is this wonderful day when that gets opened on a hot summer day and everyone plays in the water. So there's many pictures from that scene that I just love, and you can see his talent for lighting and for drama. And of course, his portraits also. There's some very contemplative, beautiful portraits of Red Jackson sort of looking off into the distance that really shows his talent for not just photojournalism, but for fine art photography.
Yeah, he has a way of capturing, is it emotion?
It is. There's like an emotional power to a lot of his images that bring you right there into the action, or in some cases into a sad moment. There's one where Red and his friend are looking on into a casket of an even younger boy who was in a friendly gang, but he'd been murdered on the streets. And then when you do read the caption, you find out that the police had found his body and said that it was an accidental death. So it's sad sometimes.
Yeah, and then Parks actually protects Jackson in the end, doesn't he? When the police, after the story comes out, the police want his negatives. They want to go after Jackson, basically.
Yes.
Which is what Jackson was afraid of.
That's right.
And he destroys the negatives, and that's why the image that he wanted on the cover of the magazine doesn't make it. Is that, am I right?
So that's right. What happened was there was a wonderful image of Red Jackson holding a smoking gun. Mm-hmm. And when the
literally.
And when the Life magazine editors saw that picture, they said, oh, this is going to make the greatest cover. Meanwhile, Parks had made this promise to Red Jackson, if you do this for me, I promise I'm going to make things better for you and your friends and your families. And this was going to help the people in Harlem, according to Parks's original idea. And he was very nervous that if they had posted that picture on the cover of the magazine, the police would see it and Red would immediately be arrested. And so there's this story that Parks tells in his autobiography that at one point he has had this argument with the Life magazine editors about the cover, and they still say they're going to print it on the cover, and he sneaks in and gets the negative and destroys it so they can't use it on the cover. But sadly, that means he doesn't get the cover of the magazine at all. And instead, they show this, you know, basically a white guy on the cover.
Air Force,
That's right. He's an Air Force officer. And so the story ends up going all the way to the back to page 96. And then the very end of the story is pushed even further back into the magazine, and that's where all the ads are. So the power of the story was already watered down by the time it hit the press.
Interesting. There was a police detective who introduced Parks to Red Jackson, who seems a sort of force for good, standing in the background a little bit here in the story.
Yeah.
Someone was trying to help these young men. So.
That's right. And actually, this whole story begins because when Parks was looking for somebody to feature in the magazine that he could follow around and take these pictures of, the way that he found him is he was sitting in the 125th Street precinct talking to the cops about who he might find. And Red Jackson comes storming in and starts talking to that police officer, who he knows well, and says, you know, you were supposed to protect me and my friends because we made a deal that if I stood up and decided to tell people that crime is bad and I fought crime and helped the police force, that they would help us back. And when Park saw this powerful force, you know, storm into a police station, he said, that is my subject. Yeah.
As a curator yourself, you're talking about everyone's a kind of curator now, which must make you feel funny sometimes. Yeah. as an actual curator of visual images. But does the show say anything to you about curation? I mean, have you learned anything from it as the in-house curator, but also just observing it as someone who does, present images to the public?
Yeah, I think it's always nice working with another photography curator. And Russell Lord has, as I mentioned, a real interesting take on photography because he often looks at it through the lens of other media. Mm-hmm. And he had the forethought of making this very, very focused show about Gordon Parks' first photo essay for Life magazine.
Yeah, and I should say this is very unusual. I mean,
it is unusual.
Show in that way. It's very analytic and cerebral in some ways, although it's visually very interesting.
Yeah, but there really is a certain way that you need to look at the show to understand the process and the ideas behind it. And I think that that's a really interesting way of curating a show. It might even actually be sort of a trend towards curators having more of a hand in how the work is presented. You know, there's a certain way that viewers are supposed to walk through the show. Yeah. They're supposed to see the work with no labels. Then they're supposed to experience the magazines. And then lastly, they see the things that were deleted from the magazine. So having that much curatorial control is interesting and I think actually a little bit more powerful than if we'd done a Gordon Parks show and said, we're going to show everything that Gordon Parks did, because the message is so difficult to get across for something that's so broad. So this gave me the idea that actually going really focused and narrow can make a really interesting show. If you can bring your audience along to each step of this exhibition, they will actually find out possibly more about Gordon Parks than if they'd seen a broader spectrum of his work. Yeah. So I learned a lot from that, and I'm happy to bring it to Vassar.
Yeah, interesting. So the show has a political force, but it also sheds light on images and the presentation of images in an interesting way. So
yeah, absolutely. And photography can be tricky because photography is a fine art.
Yes.
But it also serves so many other purposes in our world. And if you think back to photography's history, early on, museums were really just about paintings and sculpture. And photography took a long time before it made its way into the museum canon. And photography, at that point, when it was first introduced to museum audiences, it was really just fine art photography. Mm-hmm. And it was often just small black and white gelatin silver prints by fine artists. And it's only within recent years, maybe a decade or more during that time, that an opening up has happened where photojournalism and fashion photography and documentary photography has become more of a part of museum programming. So our audiences are getting a little bit more fluid with this type of material, and museums are getting more open with what they accept as an interesting exhibition.
Can you talk about what events we can look forward to that are yet to take place in conjunction with the exhibition? There's a symposium tomorrow?
Yes, there's a faculty panel discussion that the Francis Lehman Loeb Art Center co-organized with Mia Mask, who's an associate professor in the Department of Film. And it's tomorrow, Thursday, October 22nd at 5:30 p.m. in Taylor Hall, room 203. And the participants are Mia Mask, who will be the moderator, Lisa Collins from Art, Miriam Cohen and Quincy Mills, both from History, and also Pat Wallace from English. And I'm very excited to see what take each of those professors has on the exhibition. So don't miss that. I'm excited for that. And then we'll start a film series in the next two Wednesdays, October 28th and November 4th at 5 p.m. in the Rosenwald Film Theater, also organized in collaboration with Mia Mask. We have, on October 28th, two films by Gordon Parks, Diary of a Harlem Family from 1968 and The Learning Tree from 1969. And then on November 4th, of course, we're going to screen Shaft from 1971. So don't miss that. That's a good one.
Can you tell us what else is up at the Loeb Center?
Yes. People might not know about this. We have an exhibition of Asian art at Vassar, and that's in our Project and Focus galleries. And, you know, for the last 40 years or so, thanks to increasing curricular interest in Asian art, the collection has really broadened to include more works, and through faculty support, we've gotten a lot of key gifts and made some purchases. So that show features all these works from our collection, including a Chinese ceramic Han Tower and bronze vessels. and this Japanese writing box, which is absolutely beautiful. And some of my favorites are a number of Indian works on paper. So that's in Project and Focus galleries, but upstairs on the landing gallery.
So more photography.
Yes. More photography. And I did this little focus show as a way to complement this small exhibition of Asian art, mm-hmm. where we actually have a number of works by Japanese photographers in the collection. One is an aerial cityscape by Naoko Hanjo of Tokyo, Japan, and it's this wonderful piece it's not from really high perspective, but it's just high enough so that you're looking down at this area where a bunch of cabs are parked, and they almost look like toy cars in
a
way.
Yeah, that's a famous photograph, isn't it? It's quite large.
Yes, and that's from 2005, and we acquired it in 2009. And then Kunie Sugiura, who's a female Japanese photographer who actually lives in New York since the 60s, she does these large-scale photograms. Mm-hmm. And the one in our collection has threaded flowers that were put directly onto light-sensitive paper. Mm-hmm. And it creates this delicate silhouette on a blue, sort of watery background. It's just beautiful. And then also two of our pictures by Hatakeyama, who did a river series. And we have two in the collection, and those are on view as well. And a couple other gems. So you have to come see it.
And what are you working on for the future?
So my next exhibition, which opens in April and runs through August, is called Touch the Sky, Art and Astronomy. And that's an exhibition that will coincide with the opening of the Science Building.
Hopefully.
Yes, we're hoping that's all on time. Yeah. We'll be on time. And that was really inspired by the fact that here at Vassar, of course, we have Mariah Mitchell, who was one of the founding professors here and also the first female astronomer. Mm-hmm. And I was inspired by that to think about how astronomy is this very, very old science, but forever, as far as history goes, people have been gazing at the skies and inspired by that and understanding the sky by looking and rendering what they see in stars and moon and the sun. And so there's wonderful works by a lot of contemporary artists. Yeah. In photography and painting and drawing. There's these lovely prints that Nancy Graves, a graduate of Vassar from 1961, made in the 70s, where she was inspired by the man landing on the moon. And NASA had done all these wonderful maps of what the moon surface was like. And from those maps, she made a series of 10 lunar lithographs. And I'll be showing those along with a film that she made called Reflections on the Moon, which makes you feel like you're doing your own sort of moonwalk.
Sounds great. Sounds like a lot of fun, actually, to put together.
Yeah. It is. My new obsession is everything that has to do with space.
Yeah. Have you been to the observatory yet? Well, there's one night a week.
Yes, it's open on Wednesday nights, I believe, and I'm planning on going because I would like to observe the skies through that.
So, great. So I'd like to thank you, Mary Kay, for visiting with us here on the Library Cafe again to talk about your exhibition, Gordon Parks, The Making of an Argument.
Yes, it's my pleasure. It's always nice to be here.